Didn't pick up anything, huh?
No. Okay, I'm going now.
Yeah.
This is Amy Kitchener with Royal Morales on September 9th, 1993, for part two of our interview. Let's go back a minute and talk about, you were talking about some of the important experiences when you were growing up in the Philippines.
And it's related to that, going to school and some of the things we were doing in the elementary, I remember.
Yeah, and
things that we were being taught in the elementary school, such as industrial arts and gardening, and we were developing the arts and crafts from, like weaving, making baskets, or making those games that we played in as children, as youth. And we learned that in school. Then the gardening that we used to do is sort of part of being subsistence. You live on the earth, you should plant, supplement your food. And we used to enjoy the planting of eggplants, things like that, and bitter melon, tomatoes, and the cabbages. Mm-hmm. We used to do daily activities to care for those plants, and with the guidance of some of the older students, and then mostly our teachers. And I remember kind of enjoyed a lot of that too, going to the school in the evening, trying to guard and protect those vegetables, make sure nobody's going to destroy them or steal them. And
would that
was
have happened
fun.
If you hadn't stayed there?
I think they had some cases like that, and that's probably why the teachers or the principal allow it. And interestingly enough, there's a lot of support for the independence of the for the student to be able to do this, and at that point I would say that was a highlight for some of us, to be away from the house and have a good time out in the school with your friends and with the teachers, and because you have also the opportunity to, now that they think of it, to bring your own food and even have breakfast in school. So those were fun days, and learn many of those arts and crafts that today I would say some of the things that I'm doing or trying to teach to the other young people.
Like what?
Like kite making, for instance, sipa ball making.
What is that?
Lantern. Sipa is called made of rattan, where it's shaped into a ball with a number of pentagon in it, and when you look at it, it's a pentagon shape, and there are a triangular shape, and it has the feature of a soccer ball, but you can use that as either a kickball, and with that sipa, the sipa means kick, so we kick that into the air, and you play it as long as you can keeping it up in the air, or you can play it over a volleyball, like a volleyball net, using some of the rules of volleyball or tennis. But you have to kick it, and you can play it by team, or two against two, or four against four. Or if you want the other version, you can have a bigger ball, sipa ball, and you can play volleyball with it. And those were, come to think of it, those are very practical things, because in the Philippines, we don't have the volleyball, we don't have those softball, we don't have any other kind of games. So those are ethnic games that can be played rain or sunshine. And if you wear it, the rattan, it's better. So if it's raining, it bounces, but then basically it bounces through your foot, or your arm, or your fist if you play the volleyball. A very popular game called sipa. So those are the things that I started teaching or begin to pick up again when I, in the 70s and the 80s, and start teaching the young people or do demonstration in classrooms or whoever wants to learn it.
And what is their reaction, your students' reaction?
And usually it's a very positive, and they're really interested because they've never seen it, or they This gives a sense of pride of, hey, there are some things from the Philippines that should be taught to us, or we should know, we should play. And there are many, many different games that we start teaching some of the young people, and among ourselves in the 70s, to get that ethnic, roots, identity. Yeah. For instance, the yo-yo was a Philippine toy that was bought here in the 30s by Pedro Flores, and was bought by Duncan Yo-Yo. They got the rights. That's why the Duncan Yo-Yo came from, really from a Filipino guy who bought the yo-yo here, made of those Philippine mahogany hardwood, dark wood. The sipa ball now, they have a version that they're kicking. They put it in, they put some sand or beans inside it. The haki sai,
oh, yes,
that they kick, that is a Philippine sipa. That comes from the sipa, Philippine concept.
Uh-huh.
Of course, it's not only the Philippines that play that. I've seen that even among the Thai people and other Southeast Asian people, they're now playing sipa, and apparently they also were playing it.
And what were some of the values that were instilled in you when you were growing up?
Some of the things that is specific is in relationship to extended family, culture of the closeness, of the loyalty, as we call it. I call it the circle of loyalty in the family. And they have that, so that even here we practice the value of, say, utang na loob. To utang na loob means debt of gratitude and your obligation to help your family. First you have your immediate family, then you have your extended family, and then your town mates or province mates or village folks or the people within your community that you should help. And it relates to other values that is called, in Tagalog they call it pakikisama, being together, or bayanihan, being collective, a collective effort to survive together, help together. And it's expressed through caring or being extending several help or accommodations to families. A while ago we were talking about here, and how is that expressed? It's expressed through, again, if some relatives are here who are extended family, you go after them, you search for them, and you try to be close to them. And when you go visit, they extend the respect and accommodations for you, like we do. We practice it in our home.
Are some of these relationships formalized through, you know, institutions? Like I'm thinking of, I know the Mexican and Mexican-American tradition of godparents, of compadres. Do you have something like that?
In a matter of fact, when you talk about the circle of loyalty, you talk about the extended families, then the people in your hometown, the added circle to that is the compadre-comadre system, the godfathers. So that's the other loop within that circle of loyalty. And the Spaniards, seeing the extended family circle of loyalty, then automatically added the comadre system to help, as part of their colonialization of the Philippines. And so it's now a value, part of that value system that came from
there. And it parallels the value that's already there.
Yes.
On a family.
Mm-hmm. And so it is very significant, and it's here. The extended family we talked about a while ago, I think, is somebody comes, automatically you extend your house. It's not unusual in our family and other families that the family bedroom goes to the guest, and whatever is on the table, and they will do the same thing. It perpetuates itself, and that's when you say, how do you learn it? It's already institutionalized within the family system. you go someplace. It's not unusual for some families to, some children to say, hey, I'm going to visit Uncle Pedro in the northern part of the Philippines. Heads over there, welcome, stays there as long as he wants. And they will do the same thing. They bring food, the resources, or the accommodation, whatever happens is just automatically be part of the process of relating to one another.
For more recent Filipino immigrants to the United States, do you feel that that extended family network is one of the support systems that enables people to immigrate?
I would say yes. That's probably one of the big support group system or values that is still there. Now, there's some negative and positive to it also, obviously. And there is now what I would say probably distortion of it. And it's probably relate to the conflict of values now. The class of the American value versus the Philippine value. Right, the individual, there's the Bayanihan spirit, the collective effort to do together, do things together, help one another, extend your hand to help the friends, the people, the immediate family. Here, the class comes in with the rugged individualism value of America, American society. Now the Filipino begin to see that, or begin to experience that, so there's begin to class, specifically when it comes with the second generations. And first, the second, third generations living here begin to see that, and live the American value system, and then it becomes versus the new system. So that even my children already begin to question, they say, how come you're doing all this to the families coming from the Philippines, but you don't seem to do that with those who are here, born here. And it says, well, I try to balance it, but obviously, you know, there's going to be a class, unless there's going to be some way to balance it, because it's very, very opposite. And they also see that, and they would question it, but then they don't question it that they say, don't do it. They just question, they say, well, why is it? So then you bring in the Philippine value, why this is done, and you got to explain. Then they say, oh, okay, makes sense. So some of them even do that, but there's some hesitation. But I think the more Americanized acculturation gets on to the third, fourth generation, some of that will end.
Do you feel there's a conflict of values then for second generation? Like, Third generation, really.
Yeah. There would be some conflict. There's acceptance, and well, I got to use my life example, my own experience. It's probably less threatening, or less confusing, or less difficulty with my family because they grew up with it. They're growing up with it. It's still a big part of it. There's always somebody in the house. There's always an extended family coming into the picture, so they see this. And then there's enough relationship to the Philippines and the people and relatives that they see it through writings, through letters, through visits, or whatever. And when we go home, it's the same thing. So they experience that. But probably for those who begin to really become Americanized, I'm pretty sure there's a bigger class value or classes or discomfort in relationship to that. And I think if the Philippine folks does not continue to process that or introduce it or to do it, automatically they're going to lose it. I think that's sad. I think that's not good. And that begins to, there should be some kind of a sure balance someplace at the same time maintaining both some of the values that are really good.
What would you say have been the most important values for you to teach to your children in terms of Filipino values and then American values? Which have been the most important from both of those?
I'd say that trying to help one another is a value that I try to to emphasize with the family. You have the family, you have extended family. There will always be. Make sure that you accommodate them. That's at least part of your obligation or your utang na loob. They help us, we help them, that kind. However, you are here also, and so you got to be watch for you, you know, or work towards your assertiveness of your individualism, because that's part. But find some kind of balance, you know, of the creativeness, individualism. Take care of yourself also, so that you don't just do it for. See, sometimes I can think, but the off balance there is when you over sacrifice yourself for the others and don't take care of yourself. You still have to take care of yourself and have a place and direction that you still are individual, family, but trying to still have that collective effort. I think that's part of it, and the value of education, some of the religious values, and it's obviously we used to be probably pagan, Catholic, Protestant. Now we're Protestant. So that's also part of that Protestant ethic. Work ethics and other.
How did that change occur, coming to the United States?
No, I think it occurred through my parents, the grandparents, my parents, the Americanization process that goes back to 1898, when the Philippines was occupied by America via Spanish-American War, and obviously there were a lot of Filipinos who were. They accepted Catholicism because by force or because of the pressure from the society and from the church. But at the moment of separation, independence, and liberty, democracy, and things like that, and Protestantism coming to the Philippines, many, 5 to 6% shifted. And we're just one of the few. It's still 85% Catholics, 5% to 6% Protestant. So in our town, and with my family, and that's how my father came here to begin with, was through the Protestant movement. And my mother's side, I think, were the first one to be converted to Protestants. My mother's side, my grandfather, mother's side, who was going to become a priest, and then he ended up to become a minister, lay minister, didn't go to school for it. And with that influence, that going on, my understanding was my father started courting my mother at that point in time, so you're talking back in the 20s, but my grandfather said, well, if you're going to court my, and you're going to marry my daughter, you better become a Protestant. And so that was the root. And it's a cultural thing. If you're going to be in my family, you should at least follow our traditions and our culture. And the man usually tries to follow that, and that goes back that he was poor, he didn't have anything, but then he said, well, you bring your own values, you bring yourself, so that the courting period would be either changing some of your values, study, to adjust to what you're going to go marry into. You have to go there and serve time, so to speak. You bring something towards the marriage. And I guess my father, well, okay, you got me and you got your religion. And became Protestant, and then also doing some teaching. He was part of the group that was taught early by the Americans to take on the process of Americanization. Going to school as teachers to teach the American way.
In the Philippines
through the Thomasites. And I think you're talking about Helen Brown. Helen Brown is a product of the Thomasite. So the teachers who were taught, who were there from America to teach, they gathered these young people, energetic, and then start teaching them. Soon they finish 6th grade, 8th grade, and pick them, teach them, and give them the textbook, give them a classroom, and say, you go teach. And I understand that's how my father got into a little teaching there. And then through the ministry, when the Disciples of Christ Christian Church came into that area, because that was where they were assigned.
What is your hometown?
Batat, Ilocos Norte.
And where is that?
That's in northern Philippines, Luzon, northern Luzon.
And what, so about what is 200 miles. Your first language?
Ilocano. That's the dialect or language from the Ilocos region. There are two regions, Ilocos Sur, Ilocos South, and then the Ilocos North, Ilocos Norte. And we were from the north. The interesting part of that is, out of that hometown, really, is, you're talking about religion, that's also the hometown of what they call Bishop or Father or General Aglipay. Okay, Gregorio Aglipay, who was one of the first Catholic priests who fought back in the 1898, the revolution against Spain, and asking for the freedom and liberty of the Filipino clergy who didn't have all the rights they should have. They were in the bottom of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. So Father Aglipay, during the revolution against Spain, then seceded from the church and started his own church known as the Aglipayan Church or the Philippine Independent Church, very, very close to the Episcopal Church. A great deal of their Episcopalian values, practices, and philosophies are similar to the Independent Church, so that sometimes they call them the Episcopalian of the Philippines. And the Episcopalian from the Philippines, from the United States, came to the Philippines, automatically gravitated to the Aglipayan group, and they maintain close relationship with them. So that the Aglipayans from the Philippines who are now here in the United States, they would easily fit, and they are relating to the Episcopal Church. So that was the other group. In the meantime, you have the disciples, you have the Methodists, and of the others, and you have the Baptists, and you have the Presbyterians. And the Americanization in terms of religion of the Philippines was split up by the different denomination. The disciples of the Christian church came to the north, Episcopalian stayed in the city and to the mountains, Presbyterian went to the south, the Methodist stayed in central Luzon.
So then what happened when, sort of in the first wave of immigration to the United States in what, the 20s, 30s? It sounds like what we're talking here is a lot of different religious background, cultural, language, in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a cohesive community when Filipinos came to the United States? Or were they sort of separated into different groups of based around language, religion, or culture?
I would say that there's no such real cohesive nationalistic group. Because to begin with, that was not part of the intent of the imperialists, no, or the people who occupied the Philippines. The country was already divided in languages, region, etc., culture, and whatever, all the history. There are the attempts. Spanish tried to make the attempt, and they did, in terms of the national government, you have the provincial government, the local. But in terms of the dialects and there's still the regionalism that is there. The attempt to nationalize the language was one way, and that's why the use of the Spanish, the English to nationalize, everybody speak that, and then the use of the Tagalog to nationalize the people. And that didn't come until the 40s. Before that, the people who came here, they were already divided. Matter of fact, in terms of the coming in of the first wave, it was an automatic split. They have two different places where they recruited the people to come to America. Those farmers, young, single farmers from the north, and those from the south, from the Visayan Islands, they have their own group that they recruited, and they put them in separate camps. They took the Ilocanos from the north and put them in another camp in terms of, say, in Hawaii plantation. So that there is, they segregated them in different places, and it's related to culture, religion.
Two different Filipino-American communities?
I would say yes, plus the regionalism that may be in there. And so then part of that is the growth of then if you follow it up with groups, you're either going to have come up with town people, town mates, or you come up with provincial, or their language. And then that can be reclassified too, or it can be cut off to or separated into other smaller unit in terms of, say, your own village. They would come up with a group. And then further down, there would be a religious group. They could be Catholic, they could be Protestant. In earlier times, though, of course, according to my dad, the history, I said, right here in L.A., obviously at that point in time, the first waivers in the 30s, they're basically coming together as a fellowship, partly because they were not welcomed by the churches because of racism, segregation, etc., that then they had to form their own fellowship, and the Catholics, the pagans, the atheists, and then the Protestants, they came together to provide a fellowship in Los Angeles. So you'll find that. They would also form what you call sort of like a Masonic type of group or workers' group. You would get the American Legion, the Legionnaires. You would have the Dimasalang. It's a workers' group.
I've been wondering about that.
The Dimasalang, yeah, that's part of the outgrowth of a workers' group or a Masonic type of protection for each other. And they have those as part of the group. Then you also have this religious group. Then you have the cultist group, like which group is that one? Escaped my mind. But there was another gentleman here who was in the in the 30s to the 40s, formed their own religious cult group, very, very active in terms of free Philippines or independence or related to the war or coming together in as a group to speak as a group. The development of labor unions was part of it among the farm workers. It was difficult, but there was some attempt, and there were some good, positive farm group or support group among the farmers that developed. But following some of the unionizing that was developing back in the 30s and the 40s.
Where were they for the Filipino-Americans in L.A. who were laborers? What areas were and what kinds of crops were they farming?
Great deal of the farm workers, and that's just majority of them, were either moving from one place to another, from Imperial Valley to Delano to Stockton to Salinas, and they would be doing the different whatever is the seasonal. If it's cabbage, is it for the tomatoes? Is it for the grapes? Is the celery time? Fruit, walnut, they go to Washington for the apples. Then some of them would move towards Alaska, towards the fishery, fishing industry. A lot of them were migrant, and they would be controlled by certain structure. And some of the leaders, maybe controllers or managers would be Filipinos, but basically it would be non-Filipinos. Mm-hmm. But they would go from one place to another. I would say they're the migratory people. Yeah. It's an expression that I used to hear, catch them bus. They're catching the buses all the time, catch them bus or the train to move from one place to another. You know, and some would go as a group, and usually the Ilocanos will be in the same region all the time. The Visayans would be another region, and then they come to L.A. They fight each other in the taxi dance halls.
And they do what?
Fight each other in the taxi dance halls over the women or the dances or the other things happening in town. Mm-hmm. They had their own gangs for self protection when in the Main Street, Fifth Street. That's a story in itself.
So they would live sort of in the same area, but then within that area, maybe there'd be like a dance hall, and then they'd have their different cliques, kind of.
Mm-hmm. They would patronize certain taxi dance halls. In L.A. alone, in the 30s to the 40s, there were about 11 taxi dance halls.
And when you came here, were some of those still existing?
A couple. Two or three days. There's one. Not really. We pass through, go by, but never really participate. There's still one more dance hall on 8th and Main Street. The dance. There's a dancing place over there. I think it was the Dance Land.
Was that one of the?
That's
original?
One of them. Yeah, one of the original. Still there. Still there. Operating.
Is it an important meeting place for Filipino Americans?
No. But that's where you find the hundreds and hundreds of the young men of those days for companionship, for fellowship, and because that's where they were confined to. The gambling places and the taxi dance halls, the take for the Filipinos was $2 million a year. Documented by the writers like Mac Williams, Kerry Mac Williams, and all those folks who wrote about the taxi dance halls. Up and down the coast. Wherever there was a Filipino laborer or individual groups, the taxi dance halls and the house, the prostitution and the gambling followed. That was one of the acculturation. It was exploitation by whoever, the people in control, to make money off these people. They have no other, because of anti-miscegenation law, because of non-ownership on land, because they can't live in a certain area, the only place they could hang around for socialization is either the taxi dance halls, the gambling pool halls, the barber shops, the prostitution, and then the church, if there's a fellowship. Then the formation of the labor or the Masonic group.
What kind of activities did the, like you had mentioned, the Dimas?
The Masalan? A great deal of their fellowship coming together and picnics, protection for their rights, fighting for a better place. But obviously at that point in time, they didn't really have strong leadership. They were divided, obviously, and that was part of the game plan, I think. Then you have more control if they're divided, that kind of a thing. So you move them around quickly, so they have different pit bosses, labor organizers. They were not even allowed to go to labor union. It said they have to form their own labor union activities. As farm workers or domestic workers. The domestic workers didn't really have, hotel, work in the hotel, bellboys, gardeners, houseboys, chauffeurs. That was basically it. Bellhops. Those who were in the city. And then the rest are obviously farmers. And that's 10 to 12 hours a day.
So when you came in the 50s, what do you remember as some of the very important events in the Filipino American community?
Besides the church, the picnics vivid as the July 4th picnics, the Independence Day, the Masalang or the Legionarios combined with the new leadership developing in what you would call the Filipino community of Los Angeles, for instance, that used to be in Bunker. That before FACLA, they were in Main Street, Bunker Hill, towards City Hall. Remember the dance hall we used to go around and use the Filipino community. We used to call it the Bunker Hill, Bunker Hill Filipino Hall, and it's right by Bunker Hill. 500 block, right by the freeway, not too far away from the other side of the west side of Grand. It's now empty. It's an empty lot. I was just there the other day, took some pictures. It's really empty, and that used to be our dance hall. The Filipino community was over there. There's a bar, there's a band, there's dancing every weekend. We would hang around there. Three blocks away, the other side, Temple and Figueroa would be the Filipino stores, the barber shop, the pool hall, I think there was one taxi dance hall there in the back, maybe, and then the grocery store, the restaurant, and the barber shop. That's where we used to hang around. So every weekend, I would go over there to eat either at Moron Cafe or the Traveler's Restaurant. both of them were all gone. Yeah, they all disappeared. I think they ended in the 80s.
What about other events?
Events in the July 4th picnic. I remember besides Griffith Park. What's that name over the on Soto? Soto.
Oh,
there's a park in there behind the
Hollenbeck?
Not the Hollenbeck, the one way back by the General Hospital. It's been so long. But we used to go there a lot. There's a playground there, and boy, there's hundreds of people over there, and we would play sipa, volleyball, picnic, you know, or cultural show, do cultural show over there, basketball. Some of the things we used to do were playing basketball. I remember when the name of our basketball team was Coconut.
We would play
against each other. We used to go to Delano, Bakersfield, Stockton, Salinas, and play the other guys. And that was our socialization activities.
And was there a larger organization who organized these teams?
Basically, it's the basketball league, Filipino Basketball League, and some of the young leaders, second generation. We were all second generation. So we used to do that, and then in college, some of the groups that would be active would be a Filipino alumni group, and there was a strong Filipino alumni group, and the old timers, and some of us would be part of that, and then while going to SC, then we had the Philippine Trojan Club. That was our support group in school, where we then do community activities or just school activities, but there's a monthly meeting, and there would be dances, cultural shows that we would do, perform for the school or for ourselves or for the community, or we participate in the yearly, we look forward to the yearly July 4th weekend, and say July 4th, everybody's there, you know, and that was one of the key elements. But then the big socialization that I had would be an activity would be through the church, Filipino Christian Church, which was then existing on this side of town.
Right. We talked a little bit about how, especially with the earlier immigrants, were mostly men. By the 50s, were there many Filipinas?
I would say probably there were more than what the old timers have, but it's still very few, even when we were the 50s.
How did that affect the growth of the Filipino-American community?
The intermarriage with either Anglo, Hispanic group, and that was already the pattern, and that would be continuing, and there would be a great deal of rivalry. And I remember, those days, we have a group, we have our own barcada, or our own little gang, or it's not the gang that we would say, but it's we call it barcada, the group of young Filipinos who sort of hang around. And I remember, visiting some families or some girls who grew up here, or born here, and there would be 5-6 of us going to the same house, just visiting. Maybe one or two are interested, the rest of us, or we just go as for the company and for the fellowship. And we would be accommodated without any problem. And we would go by pack. Because there were very few.
Was there a formal way that...
Not really. I think it's more whoever said it first. I'm interested, or I'm after her. I would like to know more about her. And communication. Uh-huh. So then everybody just leave it alone. Your turn comes next. And a lot of the going to Bunker Hill dance hall was part of that. So hopefully to identify some young Filipina coming in there. And one of the key things that they used to do, and that was money-making, and it's always been perpetuated, I think, is what they call the Miss Philippines. Okay, so that's part of the yearly activity. So there would be then the coming together of some of the older folks, finding out the youngest daughter around, And then they would solicit or ask the parents, and the parents usually are the one who makes the decision, and say, yeah, okay, she's going to be a candidate for Miss Philippines. Then you have 5-6 of them. Then there would be dances, so that wherever you go, if they can have, each one can have their own dance. Maybe this Friday is going to be Janet's evening. So all the money that's collected will go to her. And then the dances goes, and we have what we call a dance raffle, where you would dance. Okay, this is 50 cents a dance. So 50 cents a dance for 2 minutes, you dance. And then they may race the ante. Or they may say, okay, the highest bidder. They do that. And that happens as part of the fundraising. The girls and the parents get a cut to pay for the expenses and the clothes or whatever. And usually, you know, whoever gets the most money becomes the queen. And the second is the runner-up. Blah, 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 blah. And they would go, and we used to do that. That's one of the things we used to do, is follow the girls. If they went to Delano, we would be driving all the way to Delano, take the bus or whatever. They go to Stockton, dance over there. They go to the farm in Riverside or in Pomona. We would go there, follow them. They want, and like I said, the people they're going there is going after the older folks. And the older folks like the young people, obviously, and they like the young girls, and so this was their socialization, because there was no other women unless they go to taxi dance or the house of prostitution.
So that was in that context, the Miss Philippines social and, you know, kind of the institution of the Miss Philippine contest became very important.
Mm-hmm. And it's up to this point.
Due to the context of there not being very many Filipinas here.
It's like I said, it's related to the socialist, and it's also part of the value system of the women, status of the women. And the thing is, there's a lot of negative to that also, because then you're really exploiting the young people. The women, the girls, they go over there. So I remember some of the girls who, they hated to dance with the older folks. So, I have to do this. But the parents said, you got to go dance. So they dance with them, you know. Very unhappy about the whole thing, but they had to go through with it and do that. But it was part socialization for some of us. It's exploitation in some ways. It was for the community. Because, see, the money goes for the community and then to development. Also, that's the fruit and labor of the Miss Philippine contest of the younger ones, earlier times, is the FACLA.
They benefit.
That's the money, but FACLA. See?
Wow.
So that's, you can say, what were the goodness? And if you go into FACLA, I don't know if you saw all that, they still have it. You see all the Miss Philippines, the pictures?
Yeah.
They're the one who really, with the older folks, that was their money and their energy, their vision.
So the Miss Philippines were really from the L.A. community, not from the
L.A. community, no.
Yeah.
Now there are others. Now it's getting bigger. There's Miss this, Miss that, Miss that.
Oh, it's still a big deal.
It's a big deal. Big money-making, big socialization activity. I think a lot of it, like I said, there's some exploitation to it.
What has been the role of Filipinas in LA? I mean, in the community and so forth. Are there?
Well, the cultural value is the Filipina is a very strong part of the family and always have a high social status. Even in earlier times, even the pre-Hispanic, it's second to the woman could become a king, a queen, or a princess. If there are no male heir. So the social role status has always been almost as high as the man. And so in earlier times, and the value is the respect for the women. The priestesses were women. The faith healers were all women. So as you can tell, from the priestesses to the presidency, right, Cory Aquino. So it's always been there. It was turned around by Spain when they put the women as well. They push them back in what I call push them back, bedroom, altar, convent, or the kitchen. That's all. That's the Spanish for 350 years. And then the Americanization process tries to reverse it. They say, hey, you're too beautiful to be out in the kitchen. You better get out and be Miss this, Miss that. Go play sports and all that. And they did. Because it was already part of that. And so they went out, they got educated, they become the voters, the women's suffrage, and all that from the Philippine tradition, I mean American tradition. But it was way back, it was always there. So all they had to do is open up the box. And then they came out. So the women, so after the war, there are a lot of women who came into politics. Education, number one. The talking about the immigration pattern of the professionals, 61% were women. This is still is after World War II, even to the present. To the present, still women are still more educated. They're more into this. They're more into that. So they're more out there as compared to the men. So that the status of the woman, besides being the treasurer of the house, holds a purse string. It's still pretty high. And here, I think there's a beginning, and that's what are the things happening at this point too. You know, the assertiveness and the of the woman born here is also coming out. So it's blending of the two. I think it's always been there. You
know? Have there been women's organizations here in LA?
It's really strong. Some of the strongest organizations is the Philippine Women's Club.